3, 2, 1.
So self-orientation in as it relates to the trust equation, it essentially means, is this person putting their interest before my interest? So if I pitch you a story, have I read your bylines? Do I understand the topic at hand? Am I really interested in contributing to your overall storytelling? Or is it that I'm just trying to land a story?
Rekia Reynolds is one of the most sought-after minds in strategic communications. She's a thought leader, a tastemaker, a branding expert, a professional confrontationalist, which is something that you will hear us talk about, and so much more. To me personally, she's been a mentor, a friend, and an amazing team member. We signed with her company, Sky Blue Media, I think during the pandemic, and it feels not only familial, just so aligned and intentional. And working with Sky Blue, Rekia, Kristana, Sue has been a reminder that when you feel like the people that you are looking for do not exist and you're the only one who thinks this way, you're the only one who feels this way, you're wrong. Those people do exist and you have to remain open to receiving them, open to connecting with them. And that's how we ended up here working with Rekia and learning from her constantly. So this conversation, we get right into it. We talk about everything, deeply, deeply talk about cancel culture and the strategy behind how to handle it, and both emotionally and business-wise or professionally as a community leader. We talk about the PTSD or the impact that the culture that we're cultivating right now will have on young people, is already having on young people. We talk about how to approach storytelling thoughtfully in a way that both the journalist who's telling the story and the publicist who is helping guide the story and the person who's actually being interviewed all play these important roles, and how to be better at playing those roles. So we get into the nitty-gritty of it all. If you are an aspiring or a business mind currently, if you are a leader, if you are a storyteller, if you are someone who's just curious about culture, this conversation is for you. I can't wait to have Rekia back on. I know that this conversation is far from finished, but here's an amazing taste of Rekia Reynolds' mind, and I hope you enjoy. Rekia Reynolds. I really love this red lip on you.
Do you? Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like it, I mean, it matches the wallpaper. It matches the energy. How's your heart doing today?
You know, my heart is doing well. It's doing well. I feel like there are two ways to answer that.
Mm-hmm.
One is that I've been a little more intentional about my eating. And not to say that I'm a bad eater, but just more intentional with the intake. So I feel like from a healthy heart standpoint, and walking a little more in the morning. And then heart in a great place. Just had a good morning with my family, and my sister came over to drive me to take my dog to the groomers. And it was nice leaving him in good care. I'm not dog person, but it was nice to, that made my heart happy.
This morning I woke up and I thought, I think I might be ready to adopt another cat, because we had adopted two, like a bonded pair of cats, and one was kind of mine and one was kind of Adam's, but they were both ours, obviously. And the one that was mine passed away when we moved. Aww. And I was not into the idea of getting another one anytime soon. And this morning I woke up and then I was just like, you know, it would just really be nice though to know that it would always be cared for if I wasn't home. So that's Aww. Such a pleasant feeling.
Yeah, I like that. Yes, go ahead, get another cat.
Thanks. I appreciate your permission, which is something that I think a lot of people seek from you, as you carry this magnificent communication leadership role of guiding people in how to be more effective communicators and strategists. And I know that, you know, traditionally, if someone were to throw a label on you. They would call you a potentially a publicist or communication strategist. But, you know, we don't really like labels around here, but we love to tell people our intentions in our work. And what is your intention currently in the work that you are doing?
You know, I like that you said that, because I think intentionality is so big for me, and it's so big for the space and the work that I get to do. Everything has this overarching theme of intentionality. But being an effective communicator, being an intentional storyteller, being a storyteller to help amplify the stories of other people. So I think the reason folks have found it so hard to put myself or Sky Blue Media in a bucket, it's because communications or public relations or strategy or digital or social, even sort of the crisis / urgent care communications, because not everything is a crisis. What we do is in this bucket of, it's a slither of what we do. So we do all of these things, but I think intentionality of storytelling and being effective with the inclusivity and equitable landscape of storytelling is where we thrive, because we're the most passionate about it, the most excited about it. It's what we go to sleep thinking about, and it's what I always think about a good indication of like excitement or enthusiasm for the work that you're doing is when you can get up before your alarm clock. So like,
Oh my gosh. Yes. I love that. So especially when it's like a few minutes before. I mean, actually that's a really great reframe, because I used to actually really not like that. I'm like, I can't try to, you know, catch up on these 3, 4, 5 minutes of sleep, but now I'm just like, oh, cool. My body knows like when it's time, like we are, and it's always a little bit different every morning, but it's always exactly where it's meant to be. That really comes down to trust though, and trusting your brain to show up for you, which is something that I really care about, is like building this relationship of trust with myself. And because otherwise like the anxiety can really eat at you. Like when you are constantly trying to control things and set too many alarms or set too many reminders or put too many things on your to-do list. And as someone who does so many different things, it's easy for there to be that sense of urgency that you talked about. And you always say, like, not everything is urgent. How do you define what's urgent and what isn't?
You know, there are a few different ways, you know, I look at it, but I do want to say I set so many reminders on my phone. It's the only way that I'm able to complete tasks, because I do have to remind myself all of the time, because I'm in the thick of all of these things, into the thick of it. And so I have to just put those reminders on. But the way that we sort of determine or distinguish between a crisis.
Wait, sorry. I have to press you on this one a little bit. And then go ahead. I will get to the crisis and urgency, because the reminders. Because, you know, and I'm challenging this.
I love that you press people on things. Go ahead. Press me.
It's something that I think about too. And literally hearing you say it out loud. Okay, I'm going to be honest. I didn't realize what I said was I mentioned reminders, too many reminders. But then I realized maybe that was my higher conscious telling myself, you do that too much, because Tyler, our teammate, is on here and I owe her a lot of tasks to be completed. And I have this magnificent list here that when I look at it, I'm just like, what do you mean? There's like that means nothing to me. There's too many things on here. And I was thinking like, but if I don't write it all down, I'll carry this anxiety around that I'm forgetting something. Like, are there more efficient ways to be reminded? Because the reality is when I look at that, I feel defeated. I'm like, okay, this seems too much, too big. But they are all things that have to get done. And I haven't figured out if setting so many reminders, which is why it's unfortunately one of the best reminders for me is like when I have somebody – it's so weird when I have either Adam or Tyler text me like something I need to do and I keep it unread, and I keep it unread until I get it done, because I can't stand having a little red bubble. Like that's my mental trick that I've I don't know if that's something like that's a, I don't want to say good or bad, but it is a way I've done it. So are you like, are you using the Reminders app? Are you using your Notes app, text? Like how are, what is the most efficient way for you to get all of those things done?
So there are a few things. So from a business standpoint, we use things like Monday. We use things like Asana. We use things like Streak because we're communicating on so many different mediums.
Right.
So we have something that we use from a project management standpoint. We have things from an email standpoint. For things that I think about for the world of social, I keep it in my Notes app because, again, intentionality, when I'm writing a caption or if I'm thinking about a story that a client needs to tell, I will put it in the Notes app because that gives me sort of free form and free reign of storytelling. But for reminders, I need a nudge. I need the beep, 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 beep. So what I do, instead of writing out a to-do list, I used to write out a to-do list every day. Mm-hmm. Or type it out. Now, you know, my assistant will keep CTAs, like things that call for my immediate attention at the end of the day. But I always put reminders in my phone. I need alerts.
Like the actual Reminders app?
The Reminders, like an alarm. I put an alarm. Yeah. So I may, this is, it, and this can't work for everyone because it could, okay. For people, it could really sort of irk their nerves. If I have 35 reminders going throughout the day, can you imagine your alarm like beep, 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 beep? Or sometimes I may put the chimes on.
Just like pure anxiety.
Yeah. So I will change the ringtone and put on chimes or something like that to differentiate between my alarm and then reminders and alerts.
I love that. Wow. Okay. Urgency and crisis.
So the way that we, you know, sort of from an agency standpoint, we always have to respond to things. Like my life is responding, reacting, and being a professional problem solver. And I would say a professional confrontationalist. I'm always confrontationalist.
We have to make sure we put that in the bio.
Professional confrontationalist because, you know, I always have to confront a situation. I'm always the person that if there's something uncomfortable or there's a moment of discomfort on a call with a team, they'll say, hey, Rakia, can you step in on this? And I'm fine to do it. And I think my childhood has a lot to do with it. But I think in the world of communications, because we're still learning and unlearning old vernacular versus new vernacular. Mm. And lexicon is very important. It is evolving. The landscape is changing. So we typically will say crisis communications. But everybody over the past 18 months or 24 months, you know what a crisis is, right? Like we've had to deal with the insurrection. We've had to deal with things that are real, that are a real crisis. So right. The way that I sort of define crisis communications is something that is unstable or crude, like in a crucial time. It's crucial. And typically you have to be very decisive in the moment. And then there's urgent care communications, which means it's a different level of immediacy. So this can't wait until tomorrow. This can't wait until the end of the day. This actually has to be answered over the next 2 hours, or it can become a crisis. And so we like to get in ahead of things when it's in sort of that urgent care phase, make decisions very quickly, address and assess a situation, understanding how to make a situation situational analysis, and then say, how do we address this problem or challenge, and how are we solving it before it becomes a crisis?
Mm.
And then I've walked into crisis situations as well, you know.
It seems like being a professional confrontationalist builds you up to be a leader who knows that you cannot take anything personally. Because if you're always handling other people's situations who are your clients and like people that you have chosen to take on because you align, like when I think about signing people or building a team, I often am like a little over. I think it's such an honor when someone chooses you to be a teammate, mm-hmm. like you chose us and we chose you and that's how we got together. And there's like this innate trust that, like, especially when you're very intentional about your work, which we both are, like I am connecting with this person because they align with like the values that I have or the trajectory that I want to carry out or the way that I see the like the future. And a lot of times like you're going to have these varying variables on the relationships mm-hmm. that you're having with people. How do you maintain trust with your clients and then know that when there is a matter or like a crisis, that it isn't personal and it isn't something that you have to clean up for yourself. It's like the job that has to get done, you know, like that separation. How does that happen?
I mean, honestly, Nora, you actually said the answer in the question. That's exactly it. It's being able to assess something and really holistically differentiate. Like you can't take any of this personally. And most people are self-absorbed. They care about themselves. That's just the human brain. You care about yourself. That's why people say, put your mask on before you put someone else's on. Mm. We live in a society where self-preservation is at the top. And it's programmed in us. You know, you have to take care of yourself before you take care of someone else. And so that's no different in the world of media. It's no different in the world of crisis. It's no different in the world of a business relationship. And especially in the world of service. We are in the world of service. So more so than any other industry, we typically have to take our feelings and our sort of ideology of self-preservation. And you do that at home, or you do that with someone else, or you do that,
right,
you know, in your own time. But during the workday, when you're servicing other people, the other people do come first. And I know somebody will definitely disagree there, but in the world of service, that's how we're programmed to be. So you typically will differentiate and say, this is not about me. This is not my challenge or my problem, but it is my responsibility to insert myself to solve said problem or to tackle said challenge or to contribute to a solution. So we look at things, you know, we look at things quite differently. Now, do we sometimes at the end of the day, like, oh my gosh, you know, all leaders, people that are good leaders will take something personally. And I would say there's so many different levels of leadership. Once you get to sort of the pinnacle of leadership, you absorb so many things. Everything is your fault. You say, this is me. I own it. This has nothing to do with anyone else. And so I feel like, you know, there's an author, and I think it might've been John Maxwell, who said that there are five levels of leadership, right? There's the sort of entryway. There's the permission to be someone's leader. You sort of talked about that sort of trust there. There's also the leader that is able to enact things and work with people to get things done. That's the producer. I used to be a TV producer, so I'm very knowledgeable about being a producer. How do you get things done? And how do you get other people to get things done? By motivating them, incentivizing them, giving them the proper tools and the proper knowledge. And then it goes into developing people, the people development aspect of being a leader, where you've passed the sort of entryway, you've passed the permission phase, you've passed the people development phase, but now you're in this phase of all of those things. Like you've done mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4. And then I think during the pandemic, I feel like if there were five levels to a leader, first few years of my life, you know, one, first, you know, the middle of my career as an entrepreneur, 2, 3. And then I was probably like a 3, 4 at the onset of the pandemic. But the pandemic forced me to be a 4, 5. And so when you're at the pinnacle of leadership, you take everything personally, because at that point you're like, I may have been able to better assess the situation. I could have been better equipped. I could have had the better people. So it's just two sides to all of those things.
Yeah, paradox. Hi there. If you find our work beneficial and you want to support how we build our company at your service, you can subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/Noor. It's usually personal writings, and as I build a community on there, hopefully more. Your support is how we build. I also curate a weekly newsletter of all the things I'm benefiting from and enjoying that week. Anything from what I'm reading, watching, listening, buying, and more. Like most things, I keep it personal. You can subscribe to it at noortagori.com/newsletter. Now back to the story. When you lead and you want to like be leading by example, and also just like as for yourself, personally, I always want, like, I really believe in accountability. And like, if you mess up, just take responsibility, take accountability, right. Like, let's move on. But just like be clear about that, because we have to acknowledge so that in order to grow. And then, you know, if you have a company or if you're building something even a lot bigger than yourself, there are those moments where someone else on your team's mistake is yours to take accountability and responsibility for. And that sucks. Like,
right.
I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. That sounds awful. And also seems to be a requirement. Like, where is the balance with that? Because I don't know. Cause I take that personally.
I love that you said that, because I was talking to our operations manager and I said, early on being a leader, I would look at other people and say, no, that you own that. You did that. You know, you're the reason that this happened. And this is why it cost us this, or this is why the mistake happened. And
yeah.
And so I was definitely holding other people accountable. But now, as I've matured as a leader, it might be this and this. Hey, listen, I want you to take some accountability. But at the end of the day, I probably didn't give you all the tools that you needed to succeed. Or maybe I didn't clarify or emphasize the importance of this. Or maybe I didn't outline all of the risks in front of you. Or maybe I didn't do this. So I think as you mature as a leader, there's a this totally. And. And before, there was just a this. Like, you did this. And now it's a this and a that and a this and a oof. That.
We love the yes and. We love the openness and possibility and just so much room for growth. And I have really been honing in on applying paradox as a mentality in my life, personally and professionally. And it came naturally because I think nuance is something that I really care about. Mm-hmm. I like, as someone who is often misunderstood or misrepresented and tell stories about people who are often misunderstood and misrepresented. Anytime I hear a story or read a headline or see a post, I'm like, there's so much more behind this that I don't know, which has led me to really choosing to not have opinions on most things, because it's just like, unless it has directly impacted me, it's probably not something I need to have an opinion on. Mm-hmm. And I think today, culturally, you know, especially within press, we are constantly asking people for their opinions. We're constantly trying to figure out which side people are on, as if there are only two sides. And I think it was Carl Jung who said polarization, the opposite of polarization is paradox. And I think I've been really focusing on that. And yet I don't often see it reflected in the way mainstream stories are represented. Have you had to fight for nuance in the way that your clients' stories are represented or told?
All the time. That I would say advocacy is a huge, huge portion of the work that we do, because we want to make sure not only people are getting your name correctly or the correct pronunciations are there, or, you know, we have some clients where we have to repeatedly tell people how to pronounce her name and what is in her bio, because what they've read and what they Google is still there. But they've formed their own narrative. So we have to go through everything with a fine tooth comb and be advocates for our clients. I don't think some of our clients understand the amount of push and pull that we do behind the scenes with journalists so they have the perfect story. Because we understand the story that you're trying to tell, but most of these stories are complex and nuanced. And unless you're in the room, you won't get all of the colorful commentary and all of the pieces to the puzzle. So the role of your communicator, your advocate, the person that's working on your behalf, is to understand the complexities, understand the nuances, and be able to anticipate where there may be a hole. And so the anticipatory moments of where the holes are probably the most challenging, because you don't know what other people don't know. Sometimes we sit in meetings and we're like, dang, I thought this person knew that. And are you serious? You really said this? Or, oh my God, you were going to print this? Like, and it's like, oh my gosh, okay. Where they grew up, it was okay for them to say that. Or because of the demographic or where they live. There's so many factors into how people perceive and receive information. But well, you have to be careful. You have to be careful. I remember years ago, this is when I first started out. I think I first started my agency maybe a year or two. And I was trying to sort of advocate for a client and making sure this one talking point got in there. And I inserted myself into the conversation because I was so passionate to ensure that this one thing was said. And I was quoted. And the board, it got back to the board and they were like, why would you put yourself into this conversation? And it was my first year, you know, I was, you know,
years. That's one of those lessons that once you learn it once and then that's it.
I will never forget, because when I tell you I was lyrically lashed by the board, like, how dare you insert yourself into our story? And I remember this woman said to me, she was like, stay out of the story unless you are the story. And I was like, wow, I wasn't the story. I wasn't the story. And I had to figure out a way with some panache and finesse to help to tell stories and be an advocate for stories by staying out of the story because it wasn't my story.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that, because that's like I felt that one. I was like, oh, yep, that feels familiar. I understand. I understand that. I understand that as a journalist, because I know that my approach to journalism is very not traditional. And oftentimes in the stories that I tell, it's hard to like miss that the actual like relationship that I'm having with the person, which is a different, I mean, it's a different approach to storytelling. And it's one where I try to tell, my intention in telling stories is also rooted in like showing people how to build a relationship and trust, because I think that if you like, I essentially want you to go out and ask strangers to tell you a story, but I want you to know how to do it and how to approach it in a thoughtful and meaningful way. And there is such complexity when it comes to the relationship between journalism and PR anyway. Like I say this all the time. When press releases hit my inbox, I delete them. I don't read them. I delete all of them. Like these like the mass forwarded ones on lists that I did not sign up for, that I like, and because that's not how I get my stories. This is like of no value to me. And also it's like, I understand the generalization of sending out a press release to hit as many news inboxes for people who are like potentially they're covering multiple stories a day. But more often than not, the press releases people are sending me are not ones that are authentic to like the work that I'm doing. I will say we have an upcoming podcast guest, and it's the first podcast guest that we're having on who we got because she had like asked her PR to reach out, and she had seen a question of the day that I had done on alcohol and is writing a book on alcohol, like American alcohol culture. And she does therapy, and I was like, you know what? This makes sense. She understood the assignment, and yeah. and I was just like, that felt more thoughtful. I think it's like incredibly hard because as a journalist, you know, you mm-hmm. want to make sure that you're getting the story, no matter what the story is, for the way that you're taught traditionally, you're getting the story, no matter what the story is. In fact, if you fumble, if you mess up, if you drop something that you may have not meant to drop, if whatever it is, like the juicier, the better. And that never really sat well with me because I don't believe people owe us their stories. And so if they've given you their time and their trust, that mm-hmm. I think it's important, especially if it's like a profile piece, if it's like an investigative piece mm-hmm. and that's what you're working mm-hmm. on, like that's different. Mm-hmm. Because it's not personal. It's about responsibility. But on the personal side of things though, it's like, we've had people not fact check the pieces that they write on me because it's like that old school rule where you don't send the article before it's published. And I'm just like, yeah, but the only things I'm asking you to change are the ones that are factually incorrect. And if you don't even have a fact checker on this piece, like you're doing me a it literally has given me anxiety in doing interviews because I'm like, all I think about after the interview is what part are they going to mess up? And getting on the article and the first read, if I am interviewed in an article, the first read through once the article is published is purely for fact checking. I don't actually enjoy the piece. I just skim through it as fast as I can two or three times so that I can see if there's any mistakes. And there always are, like every single time. And it's interesting because you end up doing people's jobs for them. Do you think there's a better approach of collaboration, like an ethical collaboration between journalists and publicists or communication strategists to have where everyone's getting what they want and there's like minimal harm?
I think that journalism and the media landscape, because journalism and the media landscape have become so democratized over the past 6 or 7 years, maybe 10 years now, just the landscape has changed. I think it would be hard to do that, but I do want to go back to something you had talked about in regards to trust, because I think there is a lack of trust in everything that we do, which is why, you know, some journalists, you know, and I know my team would feel this. I don't pitch as much as I used to because I'm focused on, you know, leading and strategy and ensuring that we are meeting deliverables and such with clients, but my team that is constantly, or I have relationships where, you know, I just pick up the phone like, hey, mm-hmm. we need to do this story. And it's not like writing and crafting a pitch. I remember the days of having to write and craft so many pitches. And I would always measure whether somebody was going to cover something with the questions that they asked. If they asked a lot of questions, it was because there was a lack of trust. There was always, you know, this sort of notion of, is there a lack of trust? And one of the things that we brought into the world of Sky Blue Media, shout out to Brandon, because you talked about values at the top of our conversation, and we have a set of values that we adhere to. And he was like, hey, you know, in my last position, we had learned about the trust equation. And I was like, ooh, that sounds really interesting. How can we integrate that into the work that we do? And the trust equation is essentially credibility, right? So is this person knowledgeable about what it is that they're talking to you about? Plus reliability. Is this person who they say they are? They always deliver. And they've always been a resource. And then the intimacy. Do I feel safe with them? Do I feel seen with them? Over self-orientation. Do they care about their interests or do they care about my interests? And that really is the trust equation. So a trust equals credibility, reliability, intimacy over self-orientation. And so when I think about the example that you gave, that equals trust. So as a journalist, that person did all of the things, or that's why you're not reading or you're taking in the press releases, because in your world of journalism where you are, you want to trust the stories that you're telling. because you're so intentional with the stories that you're telling. And there are all kinds, like there's levels to leadership. There's levels to journalists. It's, hey, some people are like, I have to get it done. I want to make sure that I have X thousands of words before my X month or something like that.
Right.
And but I do think that if there was some sort of equation or mechanism that we could put into place, i.e. the trust equation in the world of media, I do think we could get somewhere a lot faster, because it's getting harder and harder to tell truthful stories because we don't trust. They're too, you know, we're living in this sort of like metaverse of things. And so if you can't trust it because it's an alternate reality, how is there credibility or reliability or intimacy? And in a world where we put at the very, very top self-preservation, how do you turn that into self-orientation? And so I just think I don't want to say we're stuck right now, but I believe that we're at the precipice or crossroads of we can go all the way to this side or we can go all the way to that side.
Can you define self-orientation a little bit for us?
So self-orientation as it relates to the trust equation, it essentially means, is this person putting their interest before my interest? So if I pitch you a story, have I read your bylines? Do I understand the topic at hand? Am I really interested in contributing to your overall storytelling? Or is it that I'm just trying to land a story for my client? Or is it just, I want to tell my story instead of saying, hey, Noor, you know, the last thing that you wrote absolutely struck a chord with me, like the example that you talked about in terms of the world of alcohol. I'm writing a book. So self-orientation is I'm understanding your needs, but I'm also understanding what I need to get done. And so there's a happy medium. I think in the world of communications, we don't look at the credibility, the reliability, the intimacy over self-orientation, over that this moment of self-orientation, which is I need to get this done. I need to tell you, I have to. And it's a put, and I'll just go back to what you said in the beginning. It is a push and pull thing. So until we can have credibility, reliability, and intimacy over our own self-orientation, I have to get this done, then we won't have trust.
Let's talk about when trust is broken. I love talking about, quote, cancel culture, call out culture with you. I think a lot of people try to have conversations around it. And I never feel like I leave listening to those conversations with like any type of solution or rehabilitation or just suggestions and to the harm that is caused. And last night I actually ended up writing a poem that I haven't written a poem like this in so many years. And it ended up kind of coming out about like cancel culture kind of, but more on such a personal level, like we've canceled ourselves essentially and how we've done that and how we've written ourselves off and decided not to think for ourselves. And what I realize is like so many people most people don't think for themselves. And I think a new form of colonization is the algorithm. And it's being presented. It's like fake objectivity. And you think that you're reading and seeing and believing the same things as the next person, but you're actually not. It's very like attuned to you. We know all of this. And because of that, the polarization has made it really hard to have conversations around when somebody makes a mistake, regardless of how harmful it is on the spectrum of harm. Obviously, we know that there are different mistakes. Have you had any productive conversations on how to approach reassessing when people get canceled or when people when people get canceled? Because right now what I'm seeing is that it's mostly rooted in shaming other people.
Mm-hmm.
And again, paradox, people can do really bad things and we can want them to be better. Like, I still want people to be better. I still want people to like, especially because maybe that experience, like the experience and the perspective, which by the way, like for really big public figures who have experienced mm-hmm. that public shaming and have had to own up to certain mistakes and stuff, like that's incredibly traumatic. We like as human beings, we were never meant to have millions and millions and hundreds of millions of people watching our every move and then commentating right. on everything that we do. And I don't experience it on the millions of levels, but I've experienced it on the thousands. And it like, you don't even have to see it to feel mm-hmm. it. You just know when it's happening, it like puts you out because that energy is still directed towards you. And we invest so much of that energy in projecting it onto other people. And I haven't been able to like entirely figure out what the best approach is. And I would love to know the things that you've heard or the things that you've cultivated yourself.
Mm-hmm. I love when people talk about, I mean, it's always a topic that I typically have to deal with in the world of cancel culture because I work in the world of crisis and urgent care comms.
Exactly, right.
And it's typically explaining to people that this is just the modern way. Like what we're doing right now is mm-hmm. a modern form of ostracism. If you go back to, depending on your cultural beliefs, if you go back to people being stoned or this herd, human beings, we operate in a herd mentality. That's just who we are. If I see two people doing it, then I'm going to pile on, which is why you scroll through somebody's photos and everybody does it. If they have 36 likes, you're not going to like it. If they have 2,000 likes, it's easy for you to just click the like button.
Whoa.
It's easier because we are programmed. Our brains work in a way of herd mentality, which is why you want to go to the restaurant that is sold out. If you are walking down the street and you see a restaurant that has 4 people in it or 40 people in it, I'm going to the restaurant with 40 people because my brain is telling me the restaurant with 40 people is in higher demand. Mm. That means the food is good. That means if I don't do it now, if I don't act on impulse, then it won't come back to me. And guess what? The one with 4 people, it will always be there. So if you understand the way that the brain naturally works on a herd mentality, then you will be more accepting of modern day ostracism. Guess what? It's going to happen and it's momentarily. Because as soon as that person is ostracized, it will last. You work through it. And if you've done something wrong, you address it head on very quickly. You move through it transparently and you take accountability. Depending on where you are in your journey, if you're a level 1 leader or a level 5 leader, because you know people think leaders are folks that are just in organization. Mm. You can be entrepreneurs, you can be working for an organization and you're still a leader. But depending on where you are in your sort of journey is how you assess the situation. The further you get, the more accepting that you'll be of, hey, people operate in herd mentality. This is how the human brain actually does work. I am supposed to be part of this. This is supposed to be a part of growth. Now, when you get to this portion of cancel culture where it is intentionally breaking someone's esteem or it's intentionally defaming someone, this is where I step in the world. I always tell clients, are they trying to defame you in any way, or are they trying to discredit you in any way? If we're looking at being discredited or defamation, that's when I say, okay, bring in the professionals. Then I'm bringing in, and it's not just me, I have a team where we analyze, we look at vulnerabilities, we look at holes. I mean, there's a science to what we do when we have to do that, because if we're brought in, I feel sorry for you. If you have to deal with
right.
us on the other side of it, because we're so used to it. Now, I actually have spoken to my therapist about this, because she's like, Rakia, you are really good at confronting a situation. And I grew up in a household and I always, I talk about this all the time with my sister. We always had some sort of challenge we were trying to get through. You know, our mother was constantly, you know, yelling at something she had us at a younger age. And I'm not saying anything about young moms because I had my child at a younger age, but I do believe that full adulthood comes around 26. Mm. And so when you're someone that might be younger than 26, you may not be dealing with situations in a way that someone that has more maturity or would have. So I grew up constantly having to face challenges or modern, you know, what people say, put out fires. So I grew up in this sort of tense, like, oh my gosh, okay, this person's coming home. I got to make sure this happens. And I always had an answer for everything. And my father used to say to me when I was a kid, Rakia, you can talk your way out of brown paper bag. Because I was always trying to make sure we didn't get in trouble. Or, oh my gosh, I don't want to get a, oh my gosh, she's coming home. She's going to be upset. She's going to give me a beating. Or she might give my sister a beating. Or she might. So here's the thing. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to politic my way out of this situation. And I'm going. So, and then into adulthood, I started working in counseling and conflict resolution. So I've been working in the world of conflict since I could talk. So, and some people, when you're programmed that way, you thrive in it because that's the only thing that you're used to. And so for me, it's always a super quick. So when I say professional confrontationalist or professional or very quick problem solver, it's only because I've been doing it for a very, very, very long time. I think in the world of cancel culture, so I bring it back to cancel culture, there are a lot of people that have not weathered many storms or have not had to deal with so much conflict throughout their lives or the level of conflict. So that's why I always say not everything is a crisis. Is it urgent? Are they discrediting you? Are they defaming you? Is your business going to be ruined? Is your reputation going to be ruined? But people have to understand that you are a human being. Human beings are going to do the same thing that they see the other 10 people next to them doing. And we move in herds. So watch and pay attention to the signals. Pay attention to people that are being canceled and why they're being canceled. Pay attention to the people that are canceling them and pay attention to the language and vocabulary they use when they're canceling someone. The best way to predict any sort of futuristic trends is to pay attention to what's happened in the past. It's all there for us to see. It's such a roadmap that people can utilize as a blueprint.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the storytelling session. I just wanted to share something with you. If you're looking for a good deed opportunity these days, my family has been working to alleviate local homelessness for over 10 years. We have a foundation called I See You. And we make care packages for people experiencing homelessness. We make family food bags with food staples and give out grocery gift cards to families in need and more. Everything is done by donation and 100% of the money goes towards community members in need. If you'd like to donate, you can through Venmo at ISY Foundation or PayPal to contact@isyfoundation.org. If you or someone you know is in need in the DC, Maryland, and Virginia area and could use our help, please DM on Instagram ISY Foundation or shoot us an email. Now back to our story. It's interesting, you know, because it's a reframe. I try not to read like tweets or write, like I try not to read anything that uses mm-hmm. that kind of language. It's like incredibly intense and like triggering for me, I suppose. And now I'm thinking about it differently because of what you said and also because of something that's come up with like my partner and I, and he is mentoring these like young leaders who are in their early 20s and they're, you know, working in marketing. They like have started their own business, or they might be teenagers actually. And
oh, that's cool.
Yeah. It's so cool. And the work that they're doing is so cool. And I, you know, he had this recent meeting with them and I asked how it went. And he said that like, we're essentially ruining our young people because right. the anxiety that they have around, because to me, when I thought about when I think about cancel culture, I think about public figures and celebrities, and that's like the space that what I didn't realize is that young people are actually having these microcosms of it. Like 100%. Even my sister, my siblings or my sister-in-laws, like they have that, that terminology. They'll use that amongst like their peers. Like, of he was canceled. And it seems like we're setting people up for a lot of failure because we're like just gushing shame at them with no reprieve or solution. Like there's no, after you're canceled, you're canceled. Like there's nothing you can really do. Like there's always almost that stain.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I know that, you know, when I was in high school or when I was in college and you experience bullying and stuff, like those are stains that stay with you. Like I remember my third grade bully. I remember when she made fun of my green hair for crazy hair day and I wanted to be like the Grinch, and she said the meanest words to me about it, and I never participated in Spirit Week again. Like I remember that so clearly. So when we're doing it more intentionally, like poking at more of the vulnerabilities, not even really calibrating the situations and just using this term as a blanket term, what patterns have you picked up that you know are going to deeply, deeply impact this upcoming generation of leaders?
I mean, so many. But I think this generation of leaders is dealing with a form of PTSD. So when you talk about, hey, I remember when this person said this thing to me. So the next time you had to make a decision to participate in Spirit Week, you didn't do it. So we have to pay attention to signals in the form of how people's body language. That's why I'm big on, you know, the nonverbal aspect of communications and paying attention to the way people speak. Are they using their hands? Are they hunched over? Because you can tell a lot about what someone says without them having to say it. And I do believe that this generation, when you talk about sort of the micro aspects of it, this generation or Gen Z, they deal in these very campfire discussions and these smaller micro communities. Whereas we are dealing with a broader or larger, like a sort of larger broadcasted analysis or example of cancel culture. When you see mean comments on Twitter, I mean, I had a conversation with a major brand today and they were like, part of this major celebrity's brand deal, we need that person to be on Twitter. And the person told them, I can't be on Twitter for my mental health.
Yeah,
and I can't 100%. Do Facebook because I don't believe in the ideology behind it. And Facebook owns Instagram, so I can't do that. And so they're like, well, in the brand deal, what do we put? And I said, well, we've got to take it old school. Can we just do fireside discussion? Can we just do chats? Can we do podcasts? Can we factor those sort of aspects out? But I do think that we have to be very careful in paying attention to now, because PTSD is upon us. And I don't think that we know the larger sense of the way that it's going to impact decision making tomorrow, the next decade, the next 20 years, the next 30 years, because the body does not forget. Your body does not forget what, I might've forgotten every single thing that you said, but I remember, oh my gosh, I had a bad taste in my mouth, or, ooh, it made the back of the hairs on my neck stand up, or, ooh, that was too much for me. So if we think about just these two past years alone, the virtual vertical of it all, the stress of all of this, the body is not going to forget this in 5 years, in 10 years, in 15 years. So the pattern is pay attention to the signals, because we've been given a lot. And I don't know if there are folks out there putting the puzzles of the pieces together. And as some folks that are like putting the puzzles of the pieces together, there's really nothing that we can do because we live in such a crowded space.
Well, in theory, we live in such a crowded space, like because when we think about like the internet being real estate and, you know, being plugged into community at all times. But let me tell you, I delete all my, I have none of the social media apps on my phone right now. And I feel like I am living in the mountains. I am literally looking out in the mountains right now. And it feels like it. I love it. And it makes me so happy. And it makes me happy to honestly hearing you say that one of your clients wanted to do this brand deal and not have any social component. And there's a potentiality around doing it old school. I mean, hey, there are such amazing and creative ways to do this old school that might be more impactful. It's like this quick, Seth Godin wrote this really amazing blog post recently.
I love Seth Godin.
Yes. Most amazing. Love him so much. And he wrote about how essentially like looking for social media metrics and I was just on a little mentoring session an hour ago with him. And he said to me, he was like, he always says this to me. He's like, you don't need any more followers. Just do the work. Like he's like, you don't need to like put yourself out there because I've shared with him the things that I've gone through with like the reactions online and stuff. And he reminds me of like what it means to do the work and how that actually like how impact is actually delivered. Because oftentimes, like, you know, when you have numbers, you think that that's the most that you can do. Cause you're like, it's reaching so many people. It's also reaching a lot of numb people, like people who are continuing to scroll, who don't want to actually do something about it. When you have a fireside chat, when you put together a little conference, which our company did a few times in the last year, when you put together an intimate dinner, when you have a podcast episode or a panel discussion, whatever it is, like you are getting people's time and vulnerability because they are feeling like this is an opportunity to be seen, heard, and valued, and not just liked, like not just like a little heart of a like, which doesn't even, you know, and I say all this like not to shade social media. I mean, so much good has come from the platform that we have built. And at the same time, it's funny, Adam will always joke around and be like, we should put together an academy for people who like end up getting a social media following, like how to approach this stuff, because nobody taught us. And now, especially now, you have like super young kids who are becoming famous overnight. Like that used to be a statement that, you know, you would say, you know, no one's an overnight sensation. Some of these people are actually overnight. And they have, and I've talked to like some of the parents of those, of the like really big TikTokers and stuff. And they're like, we still have not processed what's going on. Like, we don't understand this. And so we know when certain deals come in or certain things come in or when people are really mean, like, and some of the animosity, I don't know. It's so wild, the things that people say. Like, I was talking to this one mom whose daughter, apparently somebody had predicted her, and she's super famous on TikTok, and people had predicted her death on YouTube. And then she posted on social media that day that this video had gone viral predicting her death. And people were literally in the comments telling her to go die. And don't you feel embarrassed that you're here posting when that just happened? And I'm like, this doesn't even logically make sense. Like, what are you even
saying?
Yo, that doesn't, it feels like, I hate to be the person who says it feels like Black Mirror, but it doesn't, like, it, the pieces don't even seem to be fitting into place. And so to go back to like the young Gen Z leaders who are petrified, I remember thinking when Adam first told me, I was like, these are the same kids that most people are afraid of being canceled by. And they're walking around with crippling anxiety about the same thing. Like, what have we become? Because the PTSD is real. The burnout is real. And also, we are creating these, we are building these leaders up to be people pleasers and not be able to think for themselves. And we need people to think for themselves for innovation. We need people to lead with certainty and understanding of like what feels true to me, not what do I think people want. Because what you think people want is also what they think they want, which is also what somebody else thinks they want. And this is this entire it's like thread of uncertainty and no substance behind the belief.
Yeah, it's funny because I have to interview a 13-year-old, one of my daughter's friends. I'd ask my daughter her thoughts on this Netflix series that we were watching. Oh, I was watching. She wasn't allowed to watch it because it had too much violence in it. But I had stayed up one night and I was like, I'm going to go through all these episodes and then found out that said show was number one in 83 countries. And I was like, I need to put my head around how this happened. Was it the marketing? I'm always analyzing different campaigns.
Is this a Squid Game?
Yes. You know exactly what I was talking about.
So I just watched one episode. Okay, go ahead.
So I, you know, had, because I work in the space of social and comms, so I'm looking at, you know, TikTok, and I'm seeing, I'm seeing it. I'm looking at Instagram. I'm seeing it everywhere. I'm looking at tweets. And I asked, you know, my daughter, why do you think it was so popular? And she was just talking about, she was giving me all these threads. So she was like, interview my friend, because I don't want to do this. So I interviewed her friend, and she was saying, well, one, it brought back nostalgia for all of us. We all got to play red light, green light. Two, it made us feel like children again, because we're all so stressed out. And I said, so that made us think about kick because of the games. And she was like, and then all of us like sort of want to see ourselves. And the fact that there were things in the Squid Games that I could make at home and I could do at home, I felt like I was a part of it. And so it was like a 13-year-old just giving me these profound responses. And it was like, we are so unseen. We live in a world where it is a crowded space in all of the senses of being online, being with friends, and all at the end of the day, people just want to be seen. Mm-hmm. People just want to be seen and heard. And if that has to come through the form of long format episodic television or, you know, podcasts, I think there is something obviously amazing about the connectivity of all of the platforms and the spaces in which we occupy. But are we answering the question at the end of the day, like, are you being heard? Are you being seen? And if not, and that's another sort of indicator when working in the world of sort of crisis and urgent comms, if someone says something and you don't respond or you say no comment, you are giving someone the opportunity to not feel seen or heard. And you know what they do right after that? They say, well, then I have an entire stage. I have a world of people that obviously don't care about me, but they're out there and they're looking for the next big thing. So because you didn't respond to me and you didn't make me feel seen and heard, then I'm taking it to the streets. I'm taking it to the social media streets. And so when I say pay attention to the signals, you really do have to have a sense of attunement, and you have to pay attention to all of the signals around you.
That's so profound. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. But also, I like to interview, and this is, you know, this conversation was, you know, 13. I'm like,
I mean, that's the actual, those are, to me, those are the best conversations. Like, I think one of our consultants is my 10-year-old brother, and I quote pick his brain all the time, and I pay him, and he tells me you can pay me in like playing with me. So I like, we like, or, and I read to him and stuff. And you know, the funniest thing is he doesn't have a phone, but he has email because of school, and he emailed me a couple of days ago with a bunch of XOXOXOXO, and he sent me a Stan Lee video clip of Stan Lee talking about how he created Spider-Man and how the executives laughed at him for making a hero, a superhero, like about a spider, which people hate spiders, and making him a teenager when teenagers could only be sidekicks, and giving the teenager personal problems when superheroes don't have personal problems. Mm. And he gave this like speech on, what when you have an idea that feels so true to you, like do not listen to anybody and just do it. And when you do it, give it your absolute best shot, because it's not worth it if you're not going to give it everything. And I
love that.
Was just thinking, like, I can't believe my 10-year-old brother sent me the thing that I needed to hear the most at that very moment. And it gives me so much hope, because I know that maybe too, like, our young people are becoming jaded, where they realize, well, hey, if we're all going to be screwed by this like mentality and this culture anyway, like I'm just going to do what I want, which we see a lot of times. And like, that's why I love Like, I really admire the self-expression and the, like, the crave of nostalgia and the the wanting to just be, for better or for worse, like, however people manifest it. And it does give me a lot of hope. Like, I learned so much from them.
Same. I'm doing an IG live with her later. So we were like,
prepping. Oh, I can't wait.
Yes.
That's so exciting.
But I was asking her about, you know, social media platforms and where she sees Gen Z taking social media. And I was like, Kate, which platforms do you use the most? And she was like, well, you know, TikTok for entertainment, and I get recipes, which is, I get it. Like,
yeah,
you can get your recipes there. She was like, I don't do any of the other ones because of the feeling that I get, but I do Snapchat because it keeps me connected with my friends.
Private. Yeah. That's literally same that's with my siblings is TikTok for recipes and Snapchat for the fam. That's hilarious.
It. And it's simple. I like the simplicity of it. They've taken back all, they're like, listen, you know, you all have put everything on. What's the quote? There's like a Chanel quote, like, take that one thing off before you leave. It's like when you're somebody that dresses in a lot. Like, I used to dress in a lot, wear a hat, of earring, glasses, chain.
I know what you're talking about. It's like, remove one item.
Remove one item. And I feel like someone told me once, like, Rakia, you wear all the things. You have all the things. We, as a society, we have all the things. And it feels like Gen Z is like, all right, I'm going to take this necklace off. I'm going to take this hat off. I'm going to take this.
Yeah.
All I need is the top and the bottom. That's it. I just need the shirt. I need the pants. And I need a pair of shoes. And I need it to keep it simple. They're minimalist. And they don't care about all the stuff. So I do feel hopeful for this next gen.
Totally. I mean, we are very inspired by them. And simplicity as a concept does not mean you don't do things without excellence. And excellence is something that I think that you are also redefining a lot these days specifically. You had a very interesting personal and professional last couple of years. And something that you've really had me chewing on is like where we get the energy and strength to, you know, finish the year strong. You know, we're approaching Q4, and how do we like leave 2021 out with a bang? And you challenge that idea. And I'd love to hear you talk about why you challenge that idea and what your personal experience has been that opened your eyes to seeing excellence in that simplicity.
Right. I love that you remember that, because here's the thing. It goes back to how our brains were programmed. We always say, and I catch myself in conversations all of the time. I think I was agreeing with something you said, and I said 100%. Everything is 100%. 100%.
I love saying that, though. I love it.
It's like 100%. Or 100%. Somebody in my office used to say 100p. But we are so – right. And I'm like, girl, what'd you say? 100p. exactly. I was like – girl, break it down for me. But 100%. We are so used to finishing everything strong, going, you know, everything has to just be grandiose. And I think that there is a reprogramming of our own brains that we should do. How about we finish with intentionality? Did we feel good about it? Not did everybody feel good about it. Do you always have to give your 100%? I don't think so. Why not 75%? What if your 75% is equivalent to someone else's 60%, is equivalent to someone else's 95%? I think it's sometimes relative. And when you talk about things that are in the form of paradox, I do think that we've got to and I'm not saying, hey, y'all, don't give it your all, because sometimes your best is not your all. Some folks will say 100% and I have to do all these things, and you like will wreck your entire brain when you should just go and show up and be your full self. And I think the way that folks measure 100% is the thing that stresses people out the most, the thing that puts us in high competition and high comparison with one another, which always gives us this sort of parameter or barometer of like, okay, when you talk about followers, how many followers do I have? How many people are liking? How many comments? And it does drive me up a wall when I see people writing captions and doing things with a call to action for likes or a call to action for follow, a call to act.
That's what my poem was called today. It was called Follow for Follow.
Girl, look at that.
Wait, I performed it, which I haven't performed in many, many years. And I just did it for a video. You should watch it. I think you'll love it.
Where is it
right now? I just posted it on Instagram before we did this.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I have to go look. Follow for follow. Well, follow for follow is always this it's this scale that we live on. Has to be 100%. We've got to do all.
Why it doesn't even make sense because it's not what you want.
No, it's you're just programmed to say it. You're
programmed. Well, you know what's hilarious? Okay, I really want to know what you think of the poem because I woke up in the middle of the night, and this is how the poem. That's how it happened, and I couldn't sleep because I kept hearing this line in my head: "I'll follow for follow if you fellow for fellow." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "This doesn't even make sense. What am I saying?" And then I wrote it, and it all came out. I was like, "Oh, now this makes sense."
Oh, I love that. I think poetry is such a form of therapy. One, yeah,
totally.
And I love that you talked about follow for follow. And I think when we think about 100%, it brings up this idea of perfectionism. And so I always like to say to folks, because there are people on my team who want to post on social media. I just had this conversation with someone 2 weeks ago because he really wanted to post this recap of something. And I was like, go ahead and post it. And he was like, well, I don't have the caption right. And I don't have this. And it's not 100% yet. I was like, but why does it have to be 100%? Perfectionism.
Also for who? 100% for who?
100% exactly. Who is it 100% for? But perfectionism really does take away from being perfect. Because if you think about perfectionism, you talk about someone, and again, not to bring it back to crisis and urgent care communications, no, it can't be perfect if you're moving very quickly.
Yeah, you're 100. Yes.
100. You were about to say 100%, right?
I just love saying that because I really do agree.
Perfect, because when we think about perfectionism, it is the long haul to making sure everything is in its truest sense, in its strongest sense, in its fullest sense, and not everything has to be in its strongest, truest, fullest. Sometimes it's about moving in the right direction. Sometimes it's about doing something really quickly, doing something before someone else, and not all of those things are perfect.
Right. And I also think that, especially for social media, I had this unlock recently where I realized that strive for perfection, and it was more for the perfect time. Like, I'm not going to post on a Saturday midday, no one, whatever. And I was like, first of all,
right.
So then I'll save whatever I'm posting and then make the intention to post it the next week, which I never end up doing because I'm like, this is old. I don't want to do this anymore.
Right.
And it's like, if I'm going to reframe why I use this platform, and it's to, and I had to write this out. It's like, I use it to connect with people and to document this part of my journey. And if that's the case, then posting something at a non-optimal time or whatever, not getting that much engagement or whatever it is, doesn't matter. Because what Seth ended up saying, I don't think I ever explained, but what he said is that measuring social media metrics tells you one thing and one thing only. It doesn't tell you if the person is good at what they do or good at their craft or the content is really good. It simply tells you that that person is good at achieving numbers. It is a skill to get specific numbers on the internet, and that's what that person is good at. So if you, as a company or a brand, are approaching someone because what you want is their numbers, then okay, cool. And also I encourage you to ask yourself, do I want numbers for sales or for people to understand us or whatever it is? Because those numbers, also people who are really good at getting numbers, doesn't mean that they're good at getting impactful, like humans behind the numbers.
Right.
So there's also that disconnect. And if you're, and if it's for the impact, then you really have to kind of reframe your approach and you reach out to different people. And I think that that's also why, like, I've noticed a lot of companies or brands reach out to people with smaller platforms rather than really big ones, because they know that, like, they're really getting to a specific group of people. And Seth calls it, like, the smallest viable audience. And that's the group of people that you want to focus on, like the people mm-hmm. Who are engaged with you in a way that actually there is, like, this reciprocal exchange of impact. And I see so much value in that now that I'm like, you're right. You know what? I don't ever need to gain another follower. Like, I don't need more numbers to continue doing the work that I'm doing. I posted that poem and got a couple, I've read two messages that I've gotten about how this has impacted the person and, like, their personal life and whatever. And I was like, yo, if these were the only two people who listened to it, and those, that's mm-hmm. who it was for. But first and foremost, it was for me. Like, I needed to document this moment. This is the first time I've done a poem like this in years. Like, so I put it out. And if that's the case, then, like, I have to be okay with that. I have to be happy with that. And that's still, like, another push and pull, because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. capitalism, and it's really enticing to, like, want to make sure you're doing things that are going to get you closer to getting paid, essentially. And a lot of the things that I say are things that criticize those systems in place. So if you're not self-critical or you're not introspective in the work that you do, or you don't want to do the work better, like, that's going to impact the relationships. And I know that you are such a huge relationship person in who you bring on or who you work with or who you collaborate with. How do you approach when, you know, maybe a client of yours or a brand that you work with wants to work with somebody that you don't, like, when it transcends just you to the client and there's more people involved and you're just like, eh, I don't really feel great about this. Is it kind of like business is business, or do you have mm-mm. to go through your values list?
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of different sort of filters that I typically will go through. And then I also bring in people from the team. Like, you know, when folks talk about, like, KPIs, so just in terms of followers, people are always like, what are the KPIs that we're backstepping into? And KPIs, key performance indicators, and how is it performing? And you know, I typically challenge those things. So when you talk about reframing, I always ask the question, what did it mean? So for me, it's like more of the key meaning indicator. Like, did it mean something? Did it translate into someone? Did it actually help someone? And I think if we look at those things, and I love what Seth said about the smallest, you know, community. I think I look at ASOS. I don't work with ASOS, but I researched them a while ago and years ago. And the reason they were so successful is because they were intentional about the influencers that they utilized when they were launching. They wanted to make sure that they were using people with followings with less than 1,000, because they knew that their communities were tapped in. No one typically goes after an influencer 500, 600, but ASOS did. ASOS said, we want the people that have 600 followers. We want the people that have 800 followers, because we know that their community is really listening to them. And they are not trying to artfully, you know, display or produce any content, because they know that they don't have millions of followers. So I like that. And so for Sky Blue Media, you know, our values are trust, because we talk about trust. Blue is the color of trust, honesty, and sincerity. And so our values are very close cousins: trust, authenticity, integrity, freedom of creative expression and thought, equity in communications, and storytelling. Those are our values. So if they don't fit into those filters, and we've had so many clients come to us and we're like, eh, it doesn't align. And because I've communicated our values ad nauseum, at most times to the team, people will say, hey, Rakia, this person just reached out to us, but we know that they're not the right fit for us. So we're going to, you know, refer them to X, Y, and Z person. So I don't have to make a lot of those decisions at this point, because folks are so immersed in the world of our value systems and our beliefs that they know. They're like, oh, this person is not aligned. Oh, that's not going to work.
That's goals. That is goals. It's what we try to do at Your Service. And one of my like personal mantras is the more I say no, the more the world says yes. Like turning down, especially when you're turning down money, and it's like, this just doesn't align. And it's so easy to slip into a place of doubt or what if. And then what happens is like, when you have full trust in yourself and the things that you believe in, it just comes back so much bigger and brighter. And I really believe it. The more you say no, the more the world will give you the yeses you're looking for. All right, time for the not so rapid fire questions we have for you today.
All right, let's do it.
First one is, what is the most common request your clients have?
Being on the cover.
Oof. What's the most common magazine request to be on the cover of?
Ooh, there it runs the gamut. The cover of Vogue, the cover of Forbes, the cover of Time.
Okay, I'll let you know which one I'm looking forward to the most.
And those are because they've seen our clients on those covers and they're like, we want to be on that cover.
Yeah, just like this. What is your go-to mode for decompressing?
Oh, that's hard. Breathing, laughing. Mm. I'm full of laughter. And so decompression.
You also have one of my favorite laughs.
Do I?
No, see, I don't. Now you're going to keep it quiet.
But I'm definitely a breather, a laugher, and I watch movies to decompress.
What's the last movie that you watched that actually helps you unwind?
Oh, it was a series called Foundation, a sci-fi series.
Oh my gosh, is that good? Yeah, we were about to start that.
It's a little boring, which helped me to decompress because it's a brain work. But it's also very long. So I felt like I was mellow because I was like, all right, let me relax. Cool. Let me relax.
Do you have a favorite comedy?
Let me tell you something. When I was a kid, there was a movie called Drop Dead Fred. And sometimes I will look up YouTube clips of it because it reminds me of my childhood and it has me hysterical.
That's remarkable.
Drop Dead
That's Fred. Perfect. I love it. What is your go-to song or artist for joy?
Ooh, there's an old one called Dr. Buzzards and the original Savannah Band. And it's a song called Sun Shower, which opens up to children singing. And then she comes in and sings. And that's probably my absolutely favorite joyful song.
Hearing that felt like joy. What is your favorite thing about being a mom?
Oh gosh, their favorite one thing? Gosh, that I contributed to the well-being of raising an amazing human. I was so blessed to have been given this assignment.
Inshallah.
And people are like, oh, you do this with your kids and your kids. You've worked out with your kids. My kids are not programmed. I feel like they were given to me as good humans. So the fact that I get to be a part of the journey of these amazing humans, that's the best part for me.
I mean, you have a huge, it's like the parenting hack is that you remained open and let them be open and look what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you don't try to control people, you know.
No programs here.
No
I mean,
programs.
No rules. No.
like you can't watch a series that's too violent.
Right.
I appreciate that.
No, because then you go to sleep thinking about it and then you have dreams about it and then it can show up in another way.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. What's a book that's changed your life?
Oh my gosh. So many. But I will tell you, my favorite book of all time is a book I read in the fifth grade called A Wrinkle in Time. And it taught me to be imaginative. It taught me to be innovative. And it taught me to be a dreamer.
Love. I loved A Wrinkle in Time. I bought it used at the library when I was a kid for like 5 cents.
Love it.
What is a fun fact that people don't know about you, but that I may or may not have just found out about?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mistakenly told you, because my air purifier went off, that I am a former archery teacher. I taught at the range from age 15 through 17.
Love. And finally,
and I still shoot my bow and arrow.
Actually, not finally, but yeah, okay, love that. Who is your favorite client?
They're all my favorite. I have aspects of all of them. One of my clients put in my phone, blah, 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 favorite client.
I will do that next time I see you. And finally, my last question for you, my dearest Rakia, is what do you know for sure?
I know a lot of things, but I know that I know that I know that I was put on this earth to leave an important legacy, and I'm living and doing all of that now.
I appreciate you so much. I can't wait to do so many more of these. It feels like every time we talk, we just get right into it. And I feel so much wiser at the end. So thank you for your time and thank you for your stories and your wisdom.
Thank you. I appreciate you. This was great.
For more of Rakia's wisdom, you can follow her on Instagram at Rakia Reynolds. You can also follow Sky Blue Media. That's SKAI Blue Media. You can also check out more of their work on skybluemedia.com. As always, at your service.